Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us for our presentation, Credit Suisse presentation, Private Equity, a World of Opportunity. Today's presentation, as we mentioned in our elevator view, private equity has obviously been a topic that's been in the press quite frequently of late in the Australian market, and a lot of the press that we have seen around private equity has had negative connotations to it, and that's largely been driven by a lot of our well-known and loved local listed companies being targeted, and obviously Qantas and Coles are more recent examples of that. However, as you might well know, that is very much just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to private equity, and what we're aiming to do today is give you a better understanding of what private equity is, and to do that, Simon Ford will be presenting. Simon Ford is Managing Director of Alternative Investments here in Australia. He's been with Credit Suisse for 17 years, and he's got a very extensive bio, and I'll quickly run you through Simon's achievements. Simon was co-head of the European Pension Advisory and Structuring Group in London and served on the Markets Committee of the National Association of Pension Funds Investment Council. He joined Credit Suisse Financial Products in London in 1990. Before joining Credit Suisse, he was with JP Morgan in London from 1986, the Chicago Board of Trade from 1982, and the Sydney Futures Exchange from 1980. He holds an MBA from the University of Chicago, a Master in Science in Finance and Accounting from the London School of Economics, and a Bachelor of Engineering in Aeronautical Engineering from the University of Sydney. Simon.
Thank you all for coming. I appreciate it. About half the world's equity is private. So half the world's GDP is produced by private companies. And arguably, that's the hardest working part of the world's GDP. There are about 10 times as many companies as there are listed companies, which creates one of the opportunities for private equity. But if one doesn't own investments in private equity, then you're missing out on half the world's GDP, and arguably you're missing out on the half of the world's GDP that is working hardest. Private equity itself is a little bit more selective than that. It's the ability to go out and choose those companies which are real opportunities that have good cash flows, growth opportunities, that have good outlook, and that managers can add real value to. What I'm going to talk about today is two things. First, what Australians are doing in alternatives in general, but private equity specifically, and how they're constructing their portfolios. What is some of the best practice around the world in portfolio construction and allocations to private equity? And then what is the value proposition of private equity? You know, is it just a bunch of bright guys who are borrowing too much money and ramping it up and waiting a couple of years and selling off the company? If only life could be so easy, I might add. Or is it really a value proposition? Is it really one where these managers, many of whom have been at the business for decades, have bought and sold hundreds of businesses, are adding real value? I, of course, subscribe to the latter view. And what I'm going to do is give you an outline of exactly what value they do add and how they add it and how consistently they've added it. I might add through thick and thin. I don't doubt at the end of this there'll be questions on the current credit crunch and how that affects the market. And all I can say is, as usual, there'll be a flight to quality, and the good managers will do very well. The second-tier managers, not so well, and the third-tier managers will at last be pushed out of the business. So in many senses, we consider the current environment a very big opportunity. Credit Suisse is one of the world's largest alternative houses. On the left-hand side here, we manage $130 billion US in alternatives. I've outlined the private equity part of the alternatives that we manage there. It's about $37 billion US. About $20 billion of that is in what we call funds of funds, and the other $17 billion is in direct investment. We've been a direct investor in private equity and all forms of private equity since 1969. Most of our business was as a result of buying a mid-tier bank called DLJ, Donaldson, Lufkin and Ginetra, which I just mentioned to you because some of you may know it as one of the world's leaders in private equity for three decades, and Credit Suisse took over that business in 2000. So our private equity credentials are very, very strong. On the right-hand side, we are by far the world's largest provider of capital for third-party private equity managers. So the world's best private equity managers, in many cases, come to us to look to raise money for them. We raise over $30 billion a year for managers that raised $60 billion last year. excuse me, please, sorry. I'm getting that dreaded flu going around. My presentation is actually about high net worth. I was asked to actually speak on that. But I would add that virtually every single comment in this presentation, though the early data relates to Australian high net worth in particular, every comment is equally attributable to those of you who are advising corporate clients. High net worth investors in the world have doubled their allocations to alternatives in the last 5 years, primarily for diversification and secondarily for improved returns. To some extent, that's a reallocation of old assets. Generally speaking, alternatives includes just about anything that isn't plain vanilla listed equity, plain vanilla bonds, or in some cases, property. This particular survey excludes property and treats it as a separate asset class. The rest of the slides on Australia include property as an alternative. Most of us, of course, don't agree that property is an alternative. It's just a regular asset. But for the purposes of aggregating non-vanilla assets, we'll call them alternatives for now. There's a few slides here on the high net worth Australian investors in alternatives. This study was done by Investment Trends at the end of last year and early this year, and was commissioned by a number of financial institutions, including ourselves. It just illustrates that in the last 5 years, high net worth investors in Australia, the number that have invested in alternatives has doubled. More importantly, the high net worth investors in the country with 2 million or more in investable assets, and those certainly are beginning to be what we call real high net worth, not only have about 18% of alternatives in their portfolio, but they're looking to increase their allocations to 25%. 83% of them have already owned alternatives of some form. And this is what they've owned. 38% of them have invested in infrastructure, 35% of them in private equity, 27% of them property, et cetera, commodities, hedge funds, down to CDOs. In many senses, this slide actually illustrates two things. One is that their investments in alternatives are still not what I'd call properly structured from an asset allocation point of view. They're likely to be in infrastructure or private equity or property, but not necessarily all of them. And we, of course, would suggest that all of them have good risk-adjusted characteristics and all of them are important in a portfolio. Though my presentation is primarily about private equity, that's not negative about either listed equity in particular or about the others. The benefits of private equity are principally diversification and then good quality high returns. But the other thing about this slide is that it illustrates what I believe to be, roughly speaking, the risk-adjusted returns of assets and how one should think about allocations to these particular assets. I'm a great believer that if you take 3,000 smart people, and by the way, these people were chosen by the financial institutions that contributed to the study, and generally speaking, they were high net worth and they did, generally speaking, already earn alternatives. There were 3,000 of them, so there's a very good quality study here. Their rational behaviour is a good indication of probably what rational behaviour should do in creating a portfolio. So from the left to the right, roughly speaking, you've got better risk-adjusted returns to arguably lesser risk-adjusted returns. It's not to say that one shouldn't own a CDO, but the news in the paper at the present moment of Basis and Absolute and all the other hedge funds around the world is perhaps a reflection of the good times being a little tougher at the present moment, and the allocations to those assets should be correspondingly small. This is a slide, excuse me, that people find very interesting, certainly we do. This is the portfolio, this is the average portfolio of those 3,000 Australians. As they grow wealthier along the bottom axis, and as their income rises on the left axis. And it's actually very interesting, it's also very logical, and that is, one starts out in the bottom left-hand side, this is like the life cycle of an investor. And by the way, it would be the life cycle of an institution as well, but it's certainly the life cycle of an investor. One has cash, one first buys shares in your own name, one looks at managed funds, mortgage trusts, starts a super fund. The own home is in there as a reference point. We certainly don't consider it an asset. As one of my colleagues quipped, you're born short one house, so don't ever count it as an asset. The rest of it, though, is the portfolio as it grows, as they get wealthier, and as they look for, first of all, diversification, and then secondly, better quality risk-adjusted returns. And so they branch out as you go up to the top right-hand corner into unlisted property, LICs, hybrids, infrastructure, private equity, hedge funds, tax-effective investments, as you would expect. There's only one outlier here. There's two reference points. One is the value of a home, and the other one is self-managed super funds. Again, it's not a product. It's put in there as a reference point. The average self-managed super fund is 370,000 Aussie, or at least it was when the study is done. I suspect it's risen since June 30. But it gives you a sense of what people own in their portfolio, at least on average. In the bottom left-hand corner, we found that CFDs, the little red dot, were kind of interesting. It tends to suggest that the less wealthy and the lower incomes like gambling for a living. But the rest of it, quite frankly, we find very, very rational in terms of behaviour. Private equity is the one I'm going to focus on then. The reasons for investing in private equity that they gave were the next slide. 34% said it was to broaden the diversity and risk of their and reduce the risk of their portfolio. In other words, people are acting rationally. That's exactly what you would expect, and private equity certainly offers that. It offers the other half of the world's equity that is not listed. It also offers geographic, industry, and manager diversification. Seeking higher returns is not surprising. Advised by a professional is a little surprising. Only 20% of them claim to have been advised by a professional. One of the reasons for talking to you is that much of the population, particularly as their wealth grows and they run their own super fund, they run the family trust, claim that they look for investments on their own. And so one of the things that we're trying to do is try and join the dots, if you like, between us as a wholesale supplier and those high net worth out there that are looking for good quality product. Asset suited me, or it was opportunistic. Last slide in this little group before I get onto private equity per se is we frequently get asked, and one should get asked, is what's the risk of private equity? And so the top slide, the top little chart there illustrates that. You'll see that everyone understands the bottom left-hand corner, relative risk for return, cash is lost, government bonds next, and then one drifts up through all the other alternatives to the public equity market. We all know and love and feel confident in the public equity market, just putting aside a 10% sell-off in the last few days, but above that we put private equity. In other words, similar relative risk, but generally speaking, certainly higher returns, and I'll show the statistics on the higher returns in a minute. The reason we consider the risk the same is because private companies do exactly the same things as public companies. All the same industries, autos, defence, retail, pharmaceuticals, healthcare, financial services. All those industries in private companies are exactly the same as public companies, with one slight exception, and that is that you don't find too many private companies doing mining. Or you certainly don't find too many private equity managers investing in private mining companies. It's not to say that it doesn't occur. Clearly, lots of it in Western Australia. But it's not, generally speaking, it's the one industry category that's missing from most private equity portfolios. So the relative risk of those underlying businesses is very similar. They do, generally speaking, have slightly higher leverage. But bear this in mind. Public equities, generally speaking, approximately leverage 50-50. And if it's not, the managers are shortchanging their shareholders. And private equity is generally leveraged 2-1. In other words, the average equity check in private equity runs at the present moment at 32-34%. We have good statistics on that. So, but then private equity firms don't pay dividends. So their ability to finance and support debt is usually very strong. On the bottom is, what should my allocation to private equity be? These are, in our minds, the best and the brightest. Harvard has a portfolio just under $30 billion, Yale and Princeton between each about $15 to $18 billion. And they do have great performing portfolios. They've been at it for a long time. They've taken the best and the brightest out of their business schools and often in many cases to run their portfolios. And I would add one more thing that's important. A U.S. endowment fund, in terms of the risk-adjusted returns that it's kind of trying to create, is very similar to what a family office, a high-net-worth investor, or an Australian defined contribution pension fund is trying to do. In other words, maximise risk-adjusted returns. This is quite different from the old traditional pension fund, which in most of the rest of the world, where one has DB and one always has a takeout by the company. So this behaviour, we think, is very rational. The asset allocation is very rational. It also has proven to be very effective for these endowment funds, and arguably it should be very effective for a high-net-worth investor. And the point is that 35% of their equity allocation is private equity. They've got more or less 45 to 50% allocated to equity, and of that, 35% is in private equity. The only anomaly down there, if somebody's picked it, is Harvard's fixed income fund. I can assure you that Harvard doesn't have too much that looks like plain vanilla fixed income, and they put a lot of things that look like high yield and hedge funds in there, but we're not quite sure why they use a different categorisation to Yale and Princeton. So what then is the value proposition for private equity itself? How do private equity managers add value? How can I understand them? How can I feel comfortable and confident buying into an asset that is, broadly speaking, illiquid and which requires my capital to be fairly patient? What is private equity? It's simply an investment in a private company. Exactly the same kind of companies as public companies, it's just that they're private. One generally has control. And control is enormously valuable because if you can run a company with control, then you can change it very significantly. You can fix its capital allocations, you can fix its operations, you can fix its headcount structure, you can do anything that you like to it. You can sell off its non-core assets, you can sell off its underperforming assets. These things are quite difficult sometimes for public companies. It was the reason why the private equity managers did take a tilt at both Qantas and Coles. I mentioned both of those as great private equity opportunities, but public to privates are still a fraction of what private equity managers typically do. But those two examples are both interesting in their own right. Happy to come back later on at Q&A to talk about them. Generally speaking, one invests in private equity through an unlisted limited partnership or a trust. The product that we're going to bring out next month, which is very, very good quality private equity, is a note for various reasons related to Australian law and tax. This is one of my two most important slides here. Why invest in private equity? First of all, portfolio diversification. I mentioned yet again, if you're not in private equity, you're missing out on the world's hardest working half. 98% of the world's private equity is outside Australia, or conversely, only a tiny fraction of it's here. What is outside Australia at the top end is very institutionalized, has been at it for several decades in most cases, is systematically very good at buying, restructuring, and selling companies, and diversification offshore is always a good thing for any portfolio anyway, particularly if one thinks of one's relative cost of living as an individual or as an institution. It's important to diversify from an industrial into various industries. We believe that owning private equity, as you saw from the endowment portfolios, is a legitimate reduction of volatility of one's overall portfolio, particularly one's equity portfolio. And I emphasise this proposal to invest in private equity is definitely not an either-or. Listed public companies have a place in everybody's portfolio, but unlisted private companies definitely have a place in everybody's portfolio. It's a growing asset class. We frequently get asked, is there too much money chasing too few opportunities in the world? There's a slide in my appendix that suggests that M&A activity in private equity is still only between 20 and 25% of all M&A activity. In theory, it should be the same as M&A activity, or it should be 50% of M&A activity. They're also getting the money to do the things that they would like to do. And in a slide I'll show you in a minute, you'll see that every single company in the world at some point or other becomes a private equity opportunity. So there are no shortages of opportunities. The asset class is growing with the world's economy and as the world becomes more global. Second reason to invest in private equity is high absolute long-term returns. On the right-hand side are the 10-year and 20-year average returns of top quartile private equity in the US and Europe versus their corresponding stock markets. The details of this slide are in the back near your disclaimer, but it emphasises two things. One is in 10 and 20 years, private equity has way outperformed the listed stock markets. There's a slight caveat to this, is this data runs 3 years in arrears because private equity doesn't return anything in the first 3 years. So we didn't construct the slide just because we've had three great years in the stock market. That certainly would have affected this, but I suspected we've also seen three great years in private equity. So when we see that data, and I've looked at this slide for years and years now, I expect to see the same differential. It also emphasises one other thing, and that is the top quartile private equity is outperforming the stock markets, but median quartile in red and bottom quartile is certainly not. One has to be careful about choosing managers. That's true in excuse me, please. That's true in stock picking too. But the important thing about good quality private equity managers is they add an enormous amount of value in their operational abilities. I'll get to that in another slide, but McKinsey down the bottom here, beside the comment about repeat performance, McKinsey is one of the world's best-known corporate consulting firms, has done an extensive study on the ability of good-quality private equity managers or top-quartile private equity managers to keep performing. And as you'll see from some statistics I'll give you at the end about some of those top-quartile private equity managers, they have every ability to keep on performing. Investing in a good quality private equity manager with several hundred people who are in industry teams and who've bought and sold dozens of companies in many cases in each of their industries is kind of like investing in a mining company with two dozen Chip Goodyears running it instead of just one. It's not to say that public companies don't have great management below them, but private companies and private equity managers in particular really do attract the best and the brightest, and they're very good at consistently delivering returns, and the statistics bear that out. Access to experienced managers is important. One doesn't have to take risk here. One doesn't have to invest with a few good blokes down the road who've made an offer to get together and buy up, you know, private Australian companies. There's just no need to take that kind of risk. And I have many examples of people who come up to me and say, I did a bit of private equity in Australia, and quite frankly, it was a disappointing experience. There are some great private equity managers in Australia, and we are an investor in some of them. But in private equity, if one is either new or even an experienced investor, there's no reason to take risk there. There are great private equity managers out there who've been at it for decades. The great thing about investing in private equity is that the managers are highly selective. They wouldn't buy 10% of the companies that they look at. So unlike the stock market, where generally speaking one owns the index or close to it, in private equity, these guys go in completely open-eyed to the businesses that they invest in. So there's nothing that they can't know about buying a business. Does it have good cash flow? Does it have good management that they can afford that they can live with? Have we talked to the customers, the suppliers, the managers, the accountants, the people on the shop floor? Are we comfortable with the demographics of the particular business? Do we see growth opportunities there? They're enormously selective. They're enormously skilled because of their industry teams, and they certainly don't have to take. They certainly work hard at minimizing the risk in buying investments. Most of them rarely lose capital on investments, and that is not a rationalization. We have statistics to show that. Again, I emphasize this is in the top quartile of the better managers. There's nothing they can't ask the target company, just putting aside the public to privates for a minute, because, of course, there are no disclosure laws in private companies. And there's no pressure in private equity to manage to quarterly earnings. So there's no pressure to not invest capital, to not invest to structure a company that will be better in the longer term. And the last thing is that in private equity, the managers invest with you. They are generally equal investors to you for about 5 to 10% of the equity that goes into the investment. And there's nothing like being an owner to focus one's attention on how well you're running a company. And by the way, that's even more true when things aren't going well. They work twice as hard. That, of course, compares to public companies where typically the management own a tiny fraction of the companies that they run. How do you invest in private equity? What houses like us do is we aggregate investors on the left-hand side. All investors are treated equally in a new fund. So no one comes in, you know, having bought the penny stock and you know, having marked it up. Here, everybody is equal. It's very important. We aggregate investors, and then we invest in either single managers or we invest in funds of managers. Typically not many. 4 to 5 is not unusual. And we do the latter simply to create a bit more diversity, either geographically or by industry or by skill of the particular manager. Those managers then buy particular companies, and they're going out and buying real companies, real businesses doing real things. So if things do go badly, it's great to own a little piece of a real company as distinct from what one might own in, say, hedge fund land or CDO land. Here you're buying a little piece of a company, and you're buying it on equal terms to every investor on the left-hand side there. We look to hold those companies typically for 3 to 4 years. In fact, the average life is less than 3 years for a private equity investment. You'll see in the next slide what they're actually doing during those 2 to 3 years. And then we look to sell it. About 35% of companies bought by private equity are sold off in IPOs in the stock exchange. About 30% are sold to competitors of the business. And restructuring a business to sell on to a competitor is a perfectly rational business for a private equity house. If I have time, I'll give you some examples. And the third way they sell off is increasingly to other private equity managers. And you may say, oh, that sounds like a bit of a Ponzi scheme. Well, bear this in mind. There are 10 times as many private companies in the world as public companies. And most of them, frankly, are too small, particularly in a global economic environment, if not even a national economic environment. So the inclination to aggregate them together and build them up and create operational efficiencies, capital utilization efficiencies, and build better companies is a very strong one, and private equity is doing it very actively. One that will make you laugh is if any of you have seen the movie Kenny, crass though it is that Credit Suisse, our LBO fund, happens to be the largest porta potty operator in the United States. It's a classic roll-up. It's a mum-and-pop business with hundreds of little porta potty operators all around the country. Well, we've rolled up 7% of the entire United States, which makes us the largest operator of porta-potties in the United States at present. And we're just quietly aggregating them. And, of course, we're putting in better systems. We're putting in GPSs and all the things that you would expect to run a far more efficient business, which relies on two things, porta-potties and trucks and people. We're reducing lots of the latter. So there are lots better examples, but somehow or other Australians relate to that one. The last thing that sometimes they do is recapitalise businesses because they want to hold on to them to do more things before they sell them off. The time frame of private equity is important. You commit to private equity on day one. The commitment is usually drawn down and invested over a 2 to 3 year period. It can last 4 to 5 years. And second tier managers frequently take 4 to 5 years. First tier managers typically take 2 to 3. They then look to hold businesses, generally speaking, for 2 to 3 years before they sell them off. And that is the average that they hold them, is about 2.5 to 3 years. Occasionally, of course, they buy a company they had to work harder at and they have to own it for a little bit longer. But the average cash flow of one's investment in private equity then is investing for 3 years, getting capital and profit back over the next 3 years, and then, of course, there's always a few stragglers, and I have a slide on that. Though the investment themselves are nominally 10 years, the average cash flow time period is about 5. Every single company in the world is a private equity opportunity. Every single company starts, it grows. Sometimes it's a venture capital opportunity. We do manage venture capital, but what we're doing in Australia is not venture capital. It's classic LBOs. It matures, it becomes a cash generator for either a family or for a public company, and then at some point it gets passed on. Now, the bread and butter business for us are private companies, and the family pass on, the founders pass on. I don't mean literally, by the way. I mean they want to pass the money on. And so they look to sell out. And private equity, because private companies are illiquid, private equity becomes their buyer, generally speaking, of choice. They're too small to be listed on the stock exchange. They may be perfectly good companies, by the way. Good cash flow, good management, good people. Generally speaking, too many people and too much capital employed. But nevertheless, good companies. And we look to buy them, roll them up, restructure them, sell them on. We buy a lot of non-core public businesses. Carlisle is one of the investments we're offering next month, and Carlisle bought Hertz, the rental car company out of Ford Motor Company, about 2.5 years ago. It had been run down because Ford is obviously having so many problems in the last 3 or 4 years, so they didn't care too much about the rental car subsidiary. It was just a place to park Ford cars. They've now restructured that business, sold off the bad franchises, restructured the operations, restructured the cars and the systems and so forth, and they've just relisted it for 1.9 times what they paid for it. So that's the sale of a non-core asset of a larger public company. And the second category of investments is the bottom, is companies that have stagnated, either private companies or public companies, that haven't invested, haven't had good strategy, been in a fragmented industry, and of course Coles was a classic example of that. I mention it just because it's been in the newspaper, but anybody who owns both Woolies and Coles, or has done for the last 10 years and has read the newspaper for the last 10 years, would probably agree, or possibly agree, that Coles has been a classic takeout opportunity. Unfortunately, it looks like it's failed at the present moment, but nevertheless, you can see that's the attraction of a company that is stagnated, hasn't invested, bad systems, bad infrastructure, all sorts of things that need fixing. On the right-hand side is what we do. Private equity investors are very careful. They do a lot of pre-purchase analysis before buying the company. And there's more on the next slide. The operational transformation is the real value added. And believe me, this is going to be the real value added as credit conditions tighten. This is the value proposition of experienced private equity. And we've ranked it on the right-hand side there as roughly speaking the value they're adding. The highlight being operational transformation and operational skill. They clearly spend a lot of time sourcing. They're careful, they walk in open-eyed, they know the business, they know if it has good cash flow, they know if it has growth opportunities. They've bought and sold dozens of businesses in the industry that they're looking to buy. They've done all the due diligence and they've talked to everybody related to that business. Been out to kick the tires, as it were. Financing's relatively easy. Anyone would think that banks stand on corners and hand out buckets of cash and life isn't quite so simple. But Credit Suisse happens to be the third largest provider of finance to private equity in the world, and we're very careful about who we lend to. The top-end managers can always borrow money. So even if credit conditions tighten, they will be able to borrow, and they're pretty efficient and pretty effective at it. But the real hard work starts when you've bought the business. As Henry Kravis said, any fool can buy a company, but you should be congratulated when you sell. And you can't sell it for twice what you paid for it unless you've added real value to it. The left-hand comment is from a colleague of mine, Bill Woodburn, who's the chief operating partner of our infrastructure private equity fund. And he quipped, I heard him make this comment to a few of us about 6 months ago. He said, you know, it took us 15,000 hours to buy this company. It was London City Airport. And it'll take us 6 million hours to turn it around. By the way, he's raised the EBITDA of London City Airport in 7 months by 38.5%. It'll top 40% at the end of the year, and it's likely to stay there. Every single part of the operation of London City Airport has been broken down into little pieces, from the whole business of the airport, the aircraft operating into it, the security operation, the retail operation, the handling of aircraft, the baggage handling operation. There are 27 work streams that they have basically refurbished or transformed in order to turn around London City Airport. And I've got to say, it's breathtaking and refreshing to watch an operations team move into an asset or a company and really turn it around. These people are bright, experienced, careful, clever, and they're very good at what they do. And this list of skills here, abilities in relevant industries, ability at strategic planning and implementation, extensive company management experience, you'll find that half of the people in a private equity house are ex-operations people, COOs of major businesses, occasionally CEOs, but people who've run the businesses. To them, things like Lean, Six Sigma, Kaizen, Just In Time, this is second nature to them, and they're very, very good at it. Not to say that all of them are, but the best ones definitely are, and they're consistently good at it. They use capital efficiently, and they never buy a business they don't know how they're going to sell. And lastly, they all invest with you. 10 to 15% of the capital will be their own. Sorry, 5 to 10% of the capital will typically be their own. And that does tend to focus one's attention. And they realize these skills through genuinely increasing the EBITDA of the business and genuinely increasing the enterprise value of the business. And their records of doing that are remarkably consistent. What do we do? I won't go into the detail here. We just know them very, very well. We manage $20 billion of funds of other managers, and we look at every single skill that they've got, and we make sure that they've got it, that they can repeat it, that the same people who created the track record are still there, that they have all of the industry skills, the risk systems, the rigor that one needs to continue to crank out businesses. And of the 2,500 private equity managers in the world that we keep track of, we've invested in 200 in the last 8 years. So we're pretty selective at what we do. There are different types of private equity. Suffice to say, just briefly, that leveraged buyouts at the top are 70% of the opportunity. Venture capital is higher risk, higher return. We do a lot of real estate private equity, and it's a great space for another day. We also do a lot of increasingly infrastructure private equity. Again, great asset classes because they're quite different from companies, but attracted to private equity because they have real businesses, real assets under them. Bricks and mortar, or in the case of an airport, a port, or the occasional toll road. We run funds of funds to create sensible diversity. We're also the world's third largest buyer of secondary private equity. Secondary private equity, I might add, is as scarce as hen's teeth. We own about $5 billion of it. And if you ever invest in private equity, one of the frustrating things is the value of all the book value of it always keeps on going down because we only keep it at book value. We never mark up private companies because we don't know how to value them until we sell them. So if one is silly enough to sell private equity, secondary private equity, we're always there to buy it, but it rarely comes on the market. And there are other types, mezzanine, distressed, and commodities, etc. These are the warning signs for private equity, the things that investors need to think about. Look for diversity. I often get asked by financial planners, you know, how do I compare this to the fact that my client owns a business themselves and really likes to be hands-on, would rather invest with somebody in the local town or the local community who's starting another business, because they feel like they've got some control over that. Well, compare that risk of a single company to owning a diversified group of 60 or 80 companies that are run by great people. And although the first may be a great opportunity, the second is a far better risk-adjusted opportunity. So diversity is important. It's long-term. As the slide at the bottom, as the picture at the bottom shows, one invests for the first 3 to 4 years, and then capital and profit start to come back in 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, and occasionally there are clearly assets that drag on after that. One has to be patient. This is the money that you don't need for the next 5 to 6 years. That thing there we call is the J-curve. and in the typical average cash flow life of an investment is 5 to 6 years. So lastly then, look for diversity. Definitely look for experienced managers. You don't have to take risk in this space. There are plenty of them if one has been diligent in identifying them. High absolute returns are clearly very attractive, and what's more, again, for those who are concerned about the current credit environment, the worst year ever for top quartile private equity in the last 20 was 1998. Top quartile private equity managers delivered 8% net after fees and expenses back to their investors. If you'd invested in 1998, 99 and 2000 in the stock market and realised your investments in 01, 02, 03, you'd have definitely been flat to negative. So even in the worst credit environment, they delivered 800 to 1,000 basis points over the stock market. And frankly, that's what I expect them to keep on doing. So for those who are concerned about, you know, timing of investments, this is no better or worse, and quite frankly, it will ease off the pressure on pricing, it will ease off multiples, it will increase the equity checks going into the investments, and in many senses will make them still solid and relatively still good investments, regardless of what happens to the stock market over the next 3 to 5 years. Personally, I think it's going to keep on going up. Personally, I really do believe this is a hiccup, because the world is in a phase at the present moment where we've gone from 350 middle-class people 10 years ago to a billion middle-class people now, and we're strongly heading to 2 billion in the next 10 years or so. So I don't particularly think the world's economy is in bad shape. It may have a slowdown, as people suggest, but it's certainly in good shape, and there are certainly plenty of opportunity. But one has to be careful where one is investing, and I do think in that relative terms, there will be a flight to quality everywhere, whether it be in credit, whether it be in listed equity or in unlisted equity or private equity, and one just has to be careful where one invests. Hence, why invest in private equity? Credit Suisse is actually bringing out an investment next month for high net worth investors, which is a note for high net worth investors. It will only be available to wholesale and sophisticated professional investors. And that note is particularly attractive for Australians because if for an investment of $160,000 US paid in two installments this year and next year, they'll get access to $240,000 US of four of the world's great managers. We plan at the present moment to put managers like Apollo, Carlyle, Bain and CVC Europe, who are household names in private equity, into this fund. And if they continue to deliver the kind of returns that they have, in the case of Apollo for 16 years straight, in the case of the other three for between 20 and 25 years straight, then there's every reason to expect an investment that will deliver 20 or so percent per annum. Not in a straight line, as I mentioned. Their worst fund of all four of them was 1998. Apollo's fund only returned 10%. But 10% in an environment when the listed stock market delivered something like flat. So for those of you who are interested in the high net worth market or advising the high net worth market, look forward to talk to you or some of our BDMs. Q&A? 5 or 10 minutes.